Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Columbia Gas has reached an $80 million settlement with the Merrimack Valley communities of Lawrence, Andover, and North Andover. The money is compensation for damage wrought by last year's gas explosions and fires. It'll help pay for things like fixing roads torn up when Columbia replaced 43 miles of underground pipeline. Municipal and company officials announced the settlement at a news conference this afternoon. Andover Town Manager Andrew Flanagan was among them, and he joins us now. Hello, Mr. Town Manager.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for being with us. I know that you negotiated this settlement along with the Lawrence mayor, Dan Rivera, and North Andover's interim town manager, Lynn Savage. So can you take us inside those talks? How did this deal get done? How did you arrive at $80 million?
Sure. So the process actually began the night of September 13th when we were actively responding to the emergency in itself. We began to mobilize some of our administrative staff, in this case our finance staff, our accounting staff, and what they really did was go through a process of accounting what our expenses were in real time, so the cost of personnel, the cost of equipment, in some instances where we had to execute a contract for services, all those costs were being tabulated. So when we came into the winter and out of the real recovery efforts that happened throughout the fall, we had a general understanding of what our costs were associated with the event. Simultaneously with that, our public works director worked with his two colleagues in Lawrence and North Andover to inventory all of the impacted roads and sidewalks and soft services, so any fields or parks that were impacted by this. So we went into the negotiations armed with a lot of material and had a general understanding of what costs needed to be included in the form of a settlement if we were to agree. And the process took several months. It's a legal document, and with a legal document, everything is subject to negotiation. So we spent about 3 months negotiating the different aspects of it. But in the end, I think the agreement reflects what our costs were, and it's going to do a number of things for Andover. One being, it will certainly offset the costs we incurred. It will allow us to proceed with putting back about 19 miles worth of road curb to curb to repair and in some instances replace the impacted sidewalks, and then give us some flexibility to make strategic investments in other functions within the organization that will be reflective of what the community went through on September 13th.
And I should note that this settlement is separate from the claims that Columbia has already paid out to homeowners and businesses. Columbia's parent company said in its latest financial report that the disaster has cost it about $1.6 billion. So it's not like this $80 million settlement today is all that Columbia is paying. But at today's news conference, Lawrence Mayor Dan Rivera did suggest the company should be paying a little more.
We all wish the number was higher. But if you take into account the time value of money and the cost of lengthy litigation into account, this is a good deal.
So, Andrew Flanagan, do you agree with Dan Rivera there? I mean, you said you were keeping a very accurate ledger all throughout the process. Should it have been higher to cover the true cost?
So I think with any negotiation, we obviously would like to see a number higher than what's eventually agreed upon, but it's just that a negotiation. And for me, what was important is that all of our costs were covered, and this settlement covers all of our costs, provides us with the resources to make the investments in the infrastructure that are necessary to improve the conditions prior to September 13th. And like I said, give us some flexibility to make some strategic investments. So in that regard, the settlement gives us the ability to do what we need to do moving forward.
And we did hear from Columbia Gas of Massachusetts' new president, Mark Kempick, at today's news conference. He underscored that the payments are just one way the company is responding to the disaster.
We do realize the tremendous impact that this has had on the residents and the communities here, and we are committed to restoring people back to where they were prior to this event.
So the rhetoric there, Andrew Flanagan, certainly sounds very understanding and sympathetic, but we do know that Colombia's initial response was far from perfect. I mean, public communication was poor at the outset. We remember that a frustrated Governor Charlie Baker stripped the company of its recovery management responsibilities, and then Colombia missed its goal of returning service to all customers by Thanksgiving. So have things improved in the 8 months since?
So you're right. Initially, out of the gate, Colombia Gas fell down. In the coming weeks and months, they went through a process where they were mobilizing their own resources in an effort to try to improve the response. But I think if you were to classify the fall, you would say it was a really frustrating period for us on the municipal side in terms of our interactions with Colombia Gas. I'm hopeful based on having time be on our side for this next phase that Colombia Gas will have taken the appropriate steps in order to have a more effective and successful deployment of phase two, meaning that they have to go back into a number of homes, a number of businesses, and finish the work they were unable to complete by the end of the calendar year. And it's certainly my expectation that they do a much better job at that than they did in phase one.
Yeah, there's sort of two layers to it, right? I mean, there's the physical damage, and then there's the reputational damage. We spoke earlier today with Brigham McCown. He's the former head of the Federal Pipelines and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, and he says that it's going to take a lot more than just the settlement to rebuild the reputation of Colombia Gas.
Colombia Gas has a long road to go to repair and restore its image and restore that trust. That's not something that gets restored by writing a check. It's not something that gets restored by just saying, trust us, moving forward, we're making changes. It's something that has to be earned every day.
So how do they do that, Andrew Flanagan? I mean, how does Colombia Gas regain the trust of your community?
So I think it's accurate to say this is just one minor small step in that process of rebuilding trust. I think it's very much accurate to say that's their biggest hurdle. But I think every step that they're able to move forward in a way that is acceptable to the public, that and incremental steps will go a long way in building trust. It starts with this phase two. They've got to get in those people's houses, make good on their commitment to repair or replace what hadn't been fixed in round one. And I think then when they head into a rate hearing with the DPU in the future, make it very clear that the costs associated with making the municipalities whole, the costs that are needed to replace all the equipment in people's and businesses' homes, that's not all recovered through rate. And I think that will be a real sign of good faith. Rather than go to the DPU and say, we need to raise our rates to offset these extraordinary costs, they acknowledge that that is a cost of their mistake, and it's not become a matter of rate recovery.
I'll just note that Kempik was on our air last week. He wouldn't rule out asking for a rate hike, but he said the company isn't thinking about that at this time. That's Andrew Flanagan, Andover Town Manager. Thanks so much for your time today, sir.
Thank you.
A recent column in the Boston Herald has ignited a controversy over the business model of the Boston Phoenix, an alternative weekly paper that enjoyed a nearly 50-year run before shutting down in 2013. The Phoenix had a reputation for great journalism. It was on the clergy sex abuse story very early, and it gave serious and sustained coverage to the AIDS crisis. But the paper was also known for its notorious back page ads, which offered things like, quote, ultimate massage or oriental-style body rub and escort services, with provocative pictures and descriptions like nice young girl from Hong Kong. The Phoenix's archive is now held by Northeastern University. And the question raised by the Herald is, how should the university and the community think about the Phoenix's legacy, and how much of that legacy is the paper's back pages? Joining me now is John Carroll, WBUR senior news analyst and blogger at It's Good to Live in a Two Daily Town. John, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be here.
So part of the conflict here is over the fact that the university's library online describes these old classified back page ads as, quote, ads for roommates, romantic mates, and bandmates, without explicitly addressing the really sort of obvious suggestive nature of what those ads were really about, John. And I think that's where a lot of the anger in the recent days lies. So what do you make of that?
Yeah, sorry, this conversation is happening basically on two extremes. You've got the Boston Herald, and this sort of controversy is mother's milk to the Herald. And so they're pounding the drum. They've got people saying, you know, Northeastern should divest itself of the entire archive. And you've got Northeastern sort of giving the soft soap treatment. And I think that, you know, the rational conversation occurs somewhere in the middle between those two.
I'll just mention that I am a Northeastern alum. I feel like I should just get that disclosure out there. I'll also point out that Northeastern Libraries Dean Dan Cohen has issued a statement saying, quote, "Libraries and archives retain the past so that we can strive to learn from and not repeat our mistakes. This often means preserving materials that are troubling and offensive. It is only through honest studying and understanding of the past, including our best and worst selves, that societies can ensure human progress," end quote. So, John Carroll, I mean, that seems to me, though, is kind of a pivot, because we haven't seen that type of concession, that kind of context on the Northeastern website that sort of promotes the Phoenix until this point.
Right. And archives are supposed to record and reflect history. And I think that when you leave out that part, that the revenue model for the Boston Phoenix was very much fueled by these kinds of ads, both in the print edition and in the online edition. I think when you leave that out, you leave out significant context. And just to be clear, it wasn't just the Phoenix that did this. There were a lot of alternative weeklies, alternative publications that did the same thing. The Village Voice had Backpage.com, a much more notorious website in terms of sex trafficking. This was not unusual, which is not to say that it was, laudable.
And there were other types of ads, too, we'll point out. I mean, there were some personal ads.
There were banned ads and that kind of thing. Yeah, but to limit it to that, I think, is really misleading the public.
Well, so I think to this question about whether just putting the archive in context will be enough, you know, we talked earlier today with Nikki Bell, who's the founder and director of Living in Freedom Together, or LIFT, which is a group that supports survivors of the commercial sex trade and trafficking in Worcester. And she said no matter how you frame the archive here, if you're in possession of those old papers with those ads, you just need to call a spade a spade.
I think what happens is people just want to gloss over like the violence and prostitution and not really discuss it and kind of like excuse their participation in it. I don't think it's that people, like when this was taking place, were saying prostitution's okay or prostitution isn't violence. I mean, people have been saying that, you know, this is an inherently violent industry for a long time.
So what about Nikki's point there, John? I mean, it's sort of, it's easy to understand how it can feel unsatisfactory to just say, well, here's a digital plaque that sort of puts in context this really awful thing.
True. And you look back in as recently as 2010, the editor of the Phoenix told the Boston Globe that any solicitations were victimless crimes and that basically they have a First Amendment right to publish these escort ads. And if there's a prostitution problem online, that's for the police to deal with, not for the Phoenix to deal with. So I think that was a particularly tinned response there. But you're also looking at a very different time. I mean, to look at that publication through a Me Too lens is, in a way, that distorts history, too. It was a different time. There was a lot of criticism back then for the Phoenix. There always was. The Herald, you know, routinely called Stephen Mindich a pornographer for decades. So it wasn't that there was no criticism, but the sensibility we have now is not the same sensibility even 9 years ago.
Right. And the Mindich family is responding to all this, I'll point out. So we talked with Brad Mindich earlier. His father, Stephen, who you mentioned, John, ran the Boston Phoenix before it closed. And we asked Brad Mindich what he makes about those ads that use some language that seems pretty clear about what's really behind them. And this is some of what he told us.
What is the expectation that you think a media outlet, whether it's the Phoenix or the Globe or the Herald or Channel 5 or whatever, should have with regard to particular content? If somebody places an ad that is absolutely legal to place, that there should be some sort of censorship inside the media outlets to say, well, this could be this. It's a very dangerous territory.
So he's sort of making a legalistic argument there, John. But, I mean, news outlets do turn down ads that offend their sensibilities with some regularity.
They absolutely do. And we should be clear, this is not a First Amendment issue. This is not the government. This is a news publication that is making these decisions as they go along. I think, you know, one of the issues here is this is clouding over what is a really strong legacy of journalism. in the Phoenix. I mean, the Boston Phoenix was a farm team for some really big league writers. Susan Orlean, Janet Maslin, Joe Klein, Mark Leibovich. They did coverage that the establishment press did not do. In politics, in media, they had a music critic who won a Pulitzer Prize in 1994, Lloyd Schwartz. So this was a legitimate journalistic organization. And this part of it, this revenue model, is something that is they are fully responsible for. There's no question about it. But it's something that's in part separate from the journalistic work that they did. So I think the rational discussion here is to separate the two and hold the Phoenix responsible for what it did in both areas. And I think from a journalistic area, having an archive is a good thing for Boston and for anyone who's interested in the history of journalism in Boston.
But how do we weigh the two? I mean, I guess even if we can separate the two and hold, one in each hand, how do they stack up?
Well, everybody's going to make their own individual judgment about that.
Yeah.
I think that, where you stand on this is going to determine your overall opinion of the Boston Phoenix. But I think that it's not really legitimate to use one to delegitimize the other. So I think this revenue model was shared by a lot of alternative weeklies. I think that they should be held responsible and accountable for it. But I don't think that dismissing the entire body of work that appeared in the Phoenix is the appropriate response.
I do want to be sort of precise about the substance of what we're talking about here. I mean, some of these adult ads that are now circulating again on social media. One, for example, was for the North Main Street Spa in Providence. You do a Google search on them, you'll find the Providence Journal has reported in 2015 that it was a front for prostitution and been shut down by police. There was another one near the Mohegan Sun Casino. The local news site Patch reported that the owner of that spa had been stripped of her license and convicted in New York of promoting prostitution. So it is a concrete thing here, too, right? It's
absolutely
not just sort of a theoretical, oh, we think maybe something shady was going on.
No, absolutely. And I'm not condoning what they did. I think that we have a different sensibility right now. And the important thing, newspapers and news organizations make mistakes. The important thing, I think, is to go back and hold yourself accountable for them. In this case, it's going to be Northeastern that has to hold itself accountable because the Phoenix isn't around. But I think that sense of going out and making a public admission that this was a mistake. And, this was something that was not an admirable or even a respectable thing to do. That's Northeastern's responsibility now. And I think that when they picked up the Phoenix Archive, they picked up that responsibility as well.
Yeah. So what do they do now, John? I mean, in the moments we have left, we're in this moment of reckoning, I think, in a lot of places, universities, or whether it's monuments, or we're looking back and we're reevaluating the past in a lot of different public spheres.
I think they have to address this in a more complete way than they already have. I think somewhere in between what the Herald is calling for and what Northeastern has offered is the place to go to have something that is more substantial in terms of acknowledging the situation.
WBUR senior news analyst John Carroll. He's also the blogger at It's Good to Live in a Two Daily Town. Thanks for coming in, John.
Thank you.
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren has planted an early stake in the Democratic presidential primary with a plan to make all public colleges tuition and fee free and to cancel $640 billion of student debt. That goes even beyond the college affordability plan that Senator Bernie Sanders campaigned on in 2016. Yesterday, we discussed how Warren's proposal would work. You can catch up or revisit that conversation at radioboston.org. Today, we want to consider the next question. Is it a good idea? Here in studio to help answer is Zach Bears. He's executive director of PHENOM, the Public Higher Education Network of Massachusetts. Zach, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you.
And listeners, we'd like to hear from you as well. Do you think public college should be free for all students? Would student loan debt relief jumpstart the economy? Or would it be unfair to those who've worked hard to pay back their student loans? You can give us a ring at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or send us a tweet at Radio Boston. All right. So, gentlemen, there's basically two main planks to this proposal: the free tuition at all 2 and 4 year public colleges and the debt relief for existing student loans. So let's take them one at a time. Let's start with free tuition. Zach, should public 2 and 4 year colleges be free for all students?
Absolutely. In fact, in Massachusetts and across the country, we used to have a near-free system. We've seen tax cuts mainly benefiting the wealthy and the concurrent budget cuts that come with that that have driven up tuition and fees to such a high level. Here in Massachusetts, we have the fastest growing public college costs in the country, the second fastest growing student debt burden for public college grads within the country. And we're seeing that about 3/4 of all jobs in the state are going to require some form of 2 or 4 year certification. So we know that universal access to public higher education is incredibly important for our economy, and it's what the people of Massachusetts deserve.
Well, you're getting at part of the senator's argument here. So Warren is basically saying that a college degree now is, you know, sort of what a high school education was before. It's essential for so many careers and that all students should have access to it. And we spoke with Jeremy Thompson just yesterday on the program. He's a senior policy analyst at the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center. And he basically said it should be an extension of the K-12 system.
So in Massachusetts, almost 200 years ago, Horace Mann, then the Secretary of the Board of Education, decided we need elementary and high school education to be free, public, universal, controlled by the public, and accessible to the public. We've sort of moved the ball down the field as far as higher education goes, being universal, but we're not there yet. And that's really her goal.
So what about that, Jim Sturgis? Does that argument ring true for you that, you know, the old high school diploma is basically the college degree now, and therefore it should be covered by the state?
I agree that to some degree it's become much more important. I guess I'd say the first thing I'd say is probably that while our higher education system has its problems, I'd be fearful of the government takeover, in essence, of higher education. What it would actually do to the quality of our higher education system? Take a look at our K-12 system. Notwithstanding tons of work to improve it, we're about 27th in the world. I would say that our higher education system, given the fact that it attracts high-level students from around the world, is the envy of the world, is an incredible engine for economic growth. Now, second thing is I'd say there are two things that we should separate this into two conversations. One's the conversation about community college, and one's about four-year degree-granting institutions and advanced degree-bearing institutions. The community college issue is really not that difficult in the sense that we have Pell Grants that could cover most of a community the cost of a community college. We probably could do a little bit better on that front. And I think that whether you're Republican or Democrat, or I think even Governor Weld, who's making a run on the Republican side, I think he's expressing some interest in getting to some place where you can make community college free. I think the problem with it that lies in that is this. Take Bunker Hill Community College. I mean, no disrespect to Bunker Hill. It's a very well-run institution. But their graduation rate is between 11% and 13%. So making it free for what end? To what end? Now, some of that might be because some students are leaving because they actually have to work and make some money, then they have to come back. And I understand also that some of the folks who go to Bunker Hill are not seeking an associate's degree. So it's not exactly fair to say that. But I would say this.
Sure.
There are some institutions. There's one that's been set up in downtown Boston Financial District. It serves Boston Public School graduates. It's called Duet. It's a partnership with Southern New Hampshire University. They are able to provide an associate's degree within 2 years, maximum $11,000. If you really work your heart out, you could actually get it within a single year for about $5,500. They are aiming for a 70% completion rate. So I'd say that it really depends. What are you trying to get out of this? The four-year degree granting question is much more complex than that, but I think I'd start there with the community college question. It's not just about paying for stuff. It's actually what's the benefit to the student.
We're talking about Senator Elizabeth Warren's college affordability plan with Zach Bears. He's the executive director of the Public Higher Education Network of Massachusetts and Pioneer Institute executive director Jim Sturgis. And you can give us a ring at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Paul is calling from Bridgewater. Paul, what do you think about the senator's plan?
Yeah, I got to tell you, I'm a graduate of the old state college system here in Massachusetts back in the 60s. And my education was $200 a semester. And if it wasn't up to Ronald Reagan in the 80s, when he decided he would charge people for their higher education, we wouldn't have the situation we're in, because we'd identify the fact that we have a situation that we can pay for.
Paul, thanks for the ring. So, Zach, he's sort of echoing the personal story that we hear from Senator Elizabeth Warren as well, right? I think that she's got a campaign video out talking about a similarly low tuition rate that she paid back in the day to go to the University of Houston, I believe it was. And she's saying, look, you know, those days are gone and we need to find some way to replicate that. Does that make sense to you?
Well, I think Paul brings up both his personal stories very accurate, and he also brings up the point of paying for it. When he went to college, we did pay for it. It was part of the greatest investment in our public goods that we've ever made as a country, and it meant we had the best economy that we've ever had in our country's history. And for Senator Warren, you know, I think the core thing here is that no matter what government is, it's about redistributing value to someone. Right now, we have a government that's redistributing value from lower-income people to higher-income people. We saw this with the tax giveaway, which is about from Donald Trump, which is about $150 billion a year. Senator Warren's plan, which is a 2% wealth tax on the top 75,000 families, would raise $275 billion a year. And that would fund both of these proposals, universal child care, and give us some money to address either other issues or deficits. So I think we see here that we're talking about not saying that poor people can't get access to higher education because rich people deserve tax cuts. We're saying that all people deserve universal access to public higher education because we have more than enough money to pay for it. And I think that's what we used to do. We stopped doing that, and we've seen what's happened. We have economic strife, people who are very downtrodden, people who are very afraid that their children will not have a better future than they will. And this is a way that we can make sure that they will.
But Jim Sturgis, I think some folks are wondering, is this the best way to spend that money? So as Zach said, Warren is proposing a 2% tax on people with, you know, $50 million plus assets, and you know, you can raise a lot of money that way. She's saying, let's forgive $640 billion of student debt. She's also proposing $100 billion in new Pell Grant money. You mentioned those Pell Grants earlier, and those are a little bit more free. You can use that on, you know, non-tuition and fee expenses as well, which, as we know, can make up a lot of the cost. I'll just use UMass Amherst as an example. It's our flagship state university. If you're enrolling this fall, your total cost of attendance will be about $30,000, and 46% of that, almost half, is going to be your room and board. So Jim, I don't know, would the money be better spent on Pell Grants instead?
It's far better spent on Pell Grants and much more flexible. I agree with that. I guess the only issue I have here is, just as I think it's fair to say that those folks who say for every economic ill, the cure is a tax cut, I think the cure for every ill in terms of lack of opportunity, saying it's more money, is as brain dead as the former. What I mean by that is, look, the historical record is very, very clear. With increased federal support for higher education over the past 50 years, we've seen a high inflation rate that goes well beyond any other product in the marketplace. So if you're putting more money, but it ends up costing much more, that's a problem. Now, why does that happen? It happens because the federal government, in giving money, has to do its duty, and it has to actually think about what are the accountability measures that we need to make sure we're getting best bang for the buck. We're getting a fair, fair sports, access to sports, fair this, fair that. That's all. I make no judgment on any of that. But with that comes all kinds of regulations and burdens on the universities where they actually have to hire up on the administrative level. And if you take a look at any institution, private or public, we've seen this monumental increase in administrators. And you've seen much less emphasis on full-time faculty. You see a rush to adjunct faculty. Look, UMass, because it's a public institution, provides this data to the public. Private institutions don't do that. But if you take a look at UMass just this morning, just to for fun before coming on, I said I'll look at some data that I have in a computer already. It was 2010 to 2015 data. With a huge increase in enrollment because after the recession, lots of people wanted to make a beeline for UMass because it was more affordable. Notwithstanding the fact there's huge enrollment increase, there is actual decline in full professors at UMass. At the same time, the administrative hires went right through the roof. Mm. So the question is, what do you do with the money? And if the federal government's actually going to provide that and require accountability, which it must because it's a public entity, what's the outcome of that? And I think I have some really big doubts as to whether all this money actually leads to a heck of a lot more access for kids who need it.
Let's try to get in a couple more calls. Mike is in Framingham. Hey there, Mike, what do you think about the senator's plan?
I think it's a great idea. In fact, I'd go a step further. I would make companies and wealthy who are hiding money offshore, like, for instance, the Panama Papers, are the fact that ExxonMobil doesn't pay any taxes at all, but yet their profits are the highest in history. All these things could be fixed to help pay for such a thing. The facts are an educated public makes for a better society. And when you have an education, you're much more likely to pay taxes into the community than take it out as, you know, not as getting refunds. I mean, half the country doesn't pay taxes, and it's not they're at fault. It's just they're not making an income that can pay the taxes, and therefore you take that and you add it to people who aren't paying taxes, like Trump and people like that, or all these companies that are taking their money offshore. You've got two ends eating away at one thing, and there's just not enough to go around. So, yeah, most countries that have free education, they're far better than us on the learning curve as far as ahead education, reading levels, and so on and so on. It's a, with no pun intended, it's a no-brainer.
Mike, thanks for the ring. Just a quick fact check here. The president's leaked tax returns, which we have seen limited views of, it shows he does pay some taxes, although we don't have a clearer picture because he hasn't released all those. Let's hear from...
Not enough.
Not enough. Let's hear from David in Billerica. David, what do you think?
Hi there. I just wanted to state a couple of facts here. First of all, the first fact, I graduated from a private college in the mid-1980s. I paid a total of $40,000 for my education. My daughter is finishing up her sophomore year right now. By the time she is done, even though she's paying close to $20,000 a year, getting about $12,000 a year in tuition reimbursement from the college, she'll still be $80,000 in debt.
Wow.
As a 20-year-old young woman. Is this the type of future we want for our country?
Well, so David, let me ask you. I'm glad you called because you're getting into the second plank of the senator's plan, which I want to get to, which is this debt forgiveness idea. And as you know, people who would complain about it will say, look, that's not fair. You know, your family knew what you were getting into. You borrowed that money. You should pay it back. I mean, that was the bargain that you made. I mean, do you buy that, or is it just impossible for an 18-year-old to make an informed decision on something like that much debt?
Here's the thing. The people that are saying that went to school at a time where you could afford to go to school, take out a few loans, but still pay it back on a reasonable amount of time. How does a 20-year-old start paying back $80,000 when she's starting from ground zero? You can't do that anymore. The good old days of, well, I worked hard for my money, I pulled myself up by my bootstraps, that's a fallacy that's long gone from our country. We don't live that way anymore. We can't pull ourselves up from our bootstraps because there are too many people above us that are keeping us down. And I honestly don't know what my daughter's going to do. I can help as much as I can. But there's no way that within even 10 years after she graduates, that $80,000 is going to have a significant chunk taken out of it.
David, thanks so much for the ring and for sharing your experience. So, Zach Barris, let me come to you because I think that, you know, we don't know exactly what the circumstances of David's daughter are going to be, what her major is, what her profession is going to be. But we do know that statistically, on average, people who go to four-year colleges and take on this debt do earn a lot more money. I think it's $500,000 over their lifetime over people who have just a college diploma. So one of the critiques of the senator's plan to cancel this outstanding college debt is that it's not as progressive as she claims, that it's sort of this big giveaway to people who actually are going to earn a lot of money over their lifetimes anyway. How do you respond to that?
So two things here. This plan is incredibly progressive. If you look at not the average amounts based on incomes, you know, income 25 income quartiles is what they're called. If you look at the average debt within those incomes, you find that they're actually pretty similar. In the bottom 25%, the average debt is $24,000. In the 25 to 50% range, you have about $31,000. And in the 50 to 75% range, you also have an average of about $31,000. The issue here is that people at lower incomes have been priced out of the system. If you're in the system, you are taking on about as much debt. And that's why this is so important, why these two pieces are so interconnected. What we've had now, and I think you've heard it from a lot of the callers, is we don't have a system of informed consent. The system is so opaque that most students, not just the 18-year-olds, but their families, don't have the information they need to make informed choices. And what that does is it creates a system of coercion where you're being told you need to go and get a higher degree of some kind to get a fair job, but there really is no public option. No matter where you go, you're going to be going into debt. And I think you know, what we need to do to fix that is we need to get rid of the debt that came up under that broken system, and then we need to make sure that we have a free public option so that we never get into this mess again.
Alan is in Worcester. Alan, I understand that you've been following the conversation. What do you think?
Well, I think there's an issue of accountability here. I teach in one of the state community colleges. I think that the most successful students are the ones who have some skin in the game. I'm all in favor of reducing higher education costs dramatically. I'm all in favor of Pell Grants and any other forms of financial aid that will keep the cost down. But if they can go completely for free, there are several issues that are wrong with that. Number one, a lot of them will not have any skin in the game. They'll just play along. Number two, in the state of Massachusetts, in the state colleges, the colleges are budgeted by the state for their full-time faculty. Adjunct professors, and where I teach, the adjunct professors represent probably more than 50% of the staff. I am one of them. We bring a lot of outside experience to it. We bring a lot of background and a lot of outside experience.
Got it. Alan, thank you so much for the ring. And Jim Sturgis, I see you sort of nodding along there as Alan is talking. But what about, you know, the counterpoint that, okay, so yes, maybe you'll have some students that if they don't have skin in the game, they'll, you know, they won't take it very seriously. But maybe that's a trade worth making to give an opportunity to kids who really do want to take it seriously.
Look, I find Alan's point really interesting, and I guess if I could just for a second, Callum, I'd just like to go back to David's point for
a
second. Recall his number.
80
in the
million.
1980s.
80,000.
80,000. He also spent 40,000 when he was going to college in the 1980s. This thing called inflation. And $40,000 in the 1980s would be about $80,000 right now. No, I'm not trying to question his family's choice about borrowing all of the money that his daughter had to pay, but I'm just trying to say that we're $80,000 working and doing a bunch of other things is a little easier to do, and I say that simply as someone who's paying more than that for my child to go through college right now. I'd also like to say there are other models out there. Purdue University has this thing where if you graduate from Purdue, for a number of the students, they will actually provide all debt payments through as a percentage of what you make. It incentivizes the college to actually want to help you get placed. It makes them more attentive to you as an alum, and it makes sure that it's affordable over time. But back to your question about, you know, is it a trade-off that's worth making? There is a huge moral hazard issue here. I think, look, what about the students who worked really hard and paid off their debts already? Should they get something? Have the students who decide not to follow their passions and followed some that would get them in some earnings so they could actually pay off their debts, rather than someone decided to become an artist or an anthropologist? Nothing against anthropologists or artists.
Sure, but we understand that it's a hard profession to make it in.
Right.
Zach, just in the final seconds that we have left, is this plan even realistic, both politically and financially?
Absolutely. I mean, I think our what we think of as realistic is defined by the ideas we present, and we presented this idea really quickly on skin in the game. If we do this, academic fees are covered. Students still have housing, food, transportation skin in the game. And we've seen these statistics. Half of community college students are facing hunger on a regular basis. A large percentage are facing homelessness on a regular basis. Addressing the academic costs will help students stay in school. They can use their other aid to fund their housing, transportation, and food. And they'll have skin in the game.
That's Phenom Executive Director Zach Burns and Pioneer Institute Executive Director Jim Sturgis. Gentlemen, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
The Boston Lyric Opera this week is staging the East Coast premiere of The Handmaid's Tale as an opera. Like the hit Hulu series, it's based on Margaret Atwood's 1985 novel by the same name. Atwood imagined a totalitarian future state in which most women are infertile, and the few who can bear children are forced into sexual servitude as handmaids to powerful men. And when Atwood envisioned the setting for her dystopia, she pictured Cambridge, Massachusetts. That makes the local production, on Harvard's campus, a homecoming for Atwood's story. That's just one of the things I discussed recently with Esther Nelson, the Boston Lyric Opera's artistic director, and Paul Reuters, who composed the opera more than two decades ago. I began by asking Reuters why he turned The Handmaid's Tale into an opera long before it became a cultural phenomenon.
Because it's got so many emotional layers. And opera and emotion always should go hand in hand, because that's what music can do to any story, add the extra tier, so to speak. And besides, it's the message in the novel was and is, sadly enough, more relevant than ever.
This opera of yours premiered almost two decades ago, and yet this is the first time that it's been staged on the Northeast, and certainly the first time at Harvard. And we know that Margaret Atwood maybe envisioned this taking place at Harvard.
Basically, yeah, that's where the story unfolds in the first place.
So what's the significance of that for you? This must feel like a kind of a homecoming.
In a way it is, but I guess it's more a homecoming for Margaret Atwood. To me, it's more an added bonus that things really came together that first of all, I must say I'm extremely grateful for the Boston Lyric Opera to have picked up this very, very talented and probably not inexpensive piece, and to launch it at precisely the same place where the story began. I'm one happy composer, that is for sure.
And Esther, I'm curious, from your perspective as the artistic director, how does the music and the storyline of The Handmaid's Tale as an opera compare to some of the more traditional operas that you've worked on?
I think I look at every opera individually, and it either resonates or it doesn't. And I think we might forget sometimes some of the operas that we today consider sort of traditional operas were anything but when they premiered in their day. So I think opera actually as an inherently rebellious type of art form in many ways. So when I heard this particular opera first, I was immediately taken by it, by its musical language, by the drive of the emotional force, and it's just been a desire ever since to find the opportunity to do it. It's a very large opera. And so you need a space in which to do it, which can be challenging when you don't have an appropriate venue.
Well, let me ask you a bit about the venue, because you're staging it at the basketball arena at Harvard University, which is an unusual arena for an opera, but there's a particular reason why that is a fitting setting. Explain that.
Right. It's the Leavitt's basketball court at Harvard. And the story itself, in fact, on the first page, Margaret Atwood talks about the protagonist, actually, Alfred, talks about the Red Center, which is sort of the indoctrination center of the handmaids. And she describes it even as a gymnasium and a former place where basketball was played.
And it'll be this really immersive experience, I understand, for the audience as well, where they're sort of seated in the round around the stage for the whole thing.
And lots of sharp, lots of barbed wire and gray, ugly, hard concrete. It's perfect, perfect.
Let me ask you about one of the challenges, I imagine, in the composition, Paul, which is how you sort of convey to the audience that you're flashing back and forth between the present day in the Republic of Gilead and the time before this sort of totalitarian government has taken over. Because, you know, on screen, for example, there are certain, you know, cues that you can do. You can literally use a flash to convey that or whatnot. I mean, you don't have that. So how do you do it musically?
A challenge, of course, it was a challenge, but I guess somebody would say that I chose the easy way out. I mean, the music that what goes on in the time before Gilead is sort of slightly happy-go-lucky, minimalist, vaudeville. I mean, there's a smile on its face, so to speak, whereas as soon as we are into the oppressive world of Gilead, the music changes completely and it's hard and relentless.
Let's take a little bit of a listen to that hard and relentless music that you're talking about. So take us inside that a little bit, Paul. I mean, is there a moment in the book you remember reading that inspires that part of it? Or how do you hear that sort of really dark and foreboding music coming through in the novel?
I have music tumbling around in the back of my salted composer's mind all the time. I actually orchestrate a full orchestra sometimes when I read a novel. As a composer, it's impossible for me to explain in words why it sounds the way it does. It just comes naturally to me.
Esther, I want to ask you about a challenge that I imagine too, which is how you bring something new to what has become a pretty well-known story, right? I mean, as I mentioned earlier, The Handmaid's Tale has become a real cultural phenomenon. Even if you haven't seen the Hulu series, I think you're aware of the plot. Maybe you've read the book. Perhaps you've seen women in costume at the Women's March, for example. So how do you bring something new to the story in 2019?
And you're right, it's iconic now, really, the story, but largely because of the Hulu series, I believe. And that's a conversation I had right away with the stage director, and we are fortunate to have one of the most visionary stage directors, Anne Bogart, with us, as to how are we taking the story and really going back essentially to what is at the heart of the opera, first of all, and the novel. So you have to disengage from what it has become and focus on what it is that we're dealing with, which is the opera and the story. And our stage director very consciously steered away from wanting to imitate, if you will, the Hulu series, because this is a stage work. It's intimate. It's real. You're not looking at a screen. You have to have a sense of being right there in the midst of this terrible story. And that's the power, and always has been, of opera, that the audience feels what the characters feel.
You know the rules for a participation. You wait for the whistle. What you told in is up to you until I blow the whistle again.
It's that direct emotional communication that hits in the heart at that moment.
And I imagine there must be a tremendous emotional challenge to it as well. I'm mindful that your director, Anne Bogart, recently told the Boston Herald that, quote, something cataclysmic happens on stage every 3 or 4 minutes, and she's hardly being hyperbolic there. And, I mean, you've got really heavy themes here. I mean, there's brutal violence, there's rape, there's death. I mean, what is the mental taxation on your cast members, and how do they deal with that?
We have to also take care of the fact, as producers, that these roles are challenging emotionally and everyone deals with it in their own space. So we have to be sensitive and responsive to any artist who might have a challenge with a certain role. And we actually have professionals working with us in that capacity. But I will say, in all of this darkness, as many, many good novels and operas, it is also a work that has hope. Because, in fact, it is the protagonist here, Offred, who ultimately finds the courage to rise up against this oppression. We don't quite know whether she makes it, but we do get to the point where we know she has decided enough is enough. And to me, that's also the power of these works, that she is a very ordinary woman. And it is those people who rise up against oppression tend to often be very ordinary people who don't set out to be heroes. And that's also the powerful message and positive message of works of art like this, that we are all capable of rejecting oppression.
I did not!
That's Boston Lyric Opera artistic director Esther Nelson and composer Paul Reuters. The Handmaid's Tale Opera runs through Sunday. More information is on our website, radioboston.org. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.